do Shiva. 44.
24. Hiro is in his 20 by 30 at the U-Storit. He is spending a little time in reality, as per the suggestion of his partner. The door is open so that ocean breezes and jet exhaust can blow through. All the furniture, the futons, the cargo pallet, the experimental cinder block furniture, has been pushed up against the walls. He is holding a 1-meter-long piece of heavy rebar with tape wrapped around one end to make a handle. The rebar approximates a katana, but it is very much heavier. He calls it the redneck katana. He is in the kendo stance barefoot. He should be wearing voluminous ankle-length culottes and a heavy indigo tunic, which is the traditional uniform, but instead he is wearing jockey shorts. Sweat is running down his smoothly muscled cappuccino back and exploring his cleavage. Blisters the size of green grapes are forming on the ball of his left foot. Hiro's heart and lungs are well developed, and he has been blessed with unusually quick reflexes, but he is not intrinsically strong the way his father was. Even if he were intrinsically strong, working with a redneck katana would be very difficult. He is full of adrenaline, his nerves are shot, and his mind is cluttered up with free-floating anxiety, floating around on an ocean of generalized terror. He is shuffling back and forth down the 30-foot axis of the room. From time to time, he will accelerate, raise the redneck katana up over his head until it is pointed backward, then bring it swiftly down, snapping his wrists at the last moment so that it comes to a stop in midair. Then he says, "Next." Theoretically. In fact, the redneck katana is difficult to stop once it gets moving, but it's good exercise. His forearms look like bundles of steel cables. Almost. Well, they will soon, anyway. The Nipponese don't go in for this nonsense about follow-through. If you strike a man on the top of his head with a katana and do not make any effort to stop the blade, it will divide his skull and probably get hung up in his collarbone or his pelvis, and then you will be out there in the middle of the medieval battlefield with a foot on your late opponent's face trying to work the blade loose as his best friend comes running up to you with a certain vengeful gleam in his eye. So the plan is to snap the blade to a full stop just after the impact, maybe crease his brain pan an inch or two, then whip it out and look for another samurai, hence, next. He has been thinking about what happened earlier tonight with Raven, which pretty much rules out sleep, and this is why he is practicing with the redneck katana at 3 in the morning. He knows he was totally unprepared. The spear just came at him. He slapped at it with the blade. He happened to slap it at the right time, and it missed him. But he did this almost absent-mindedly. Maybe that's how great warriors do it. Carelessly, not racking their minds with the consequences. Maybe he's flattering himself. The sound of a helicopter has been getting louder for some minutes now. Even though Hiro lives right next to the airport, this is unusual. They're not supposed to fly right near LAX. It raises evident safety questions. It doesn't stop getting louder until it's very loud, and at that point, the helicopter is hovering a few feet above the parking lot, right out in front of Hiro and Vitali's 20 by 30. It's a nice one, a corporate jet chopper, dark green with subdued markings. Hiro suspects that in brighter light, he would be able to make out the logo of a defense contractor, most likely General Jim's defense system. A pale-faced white man with a very high forehead-cum-bald spot jumps out of the chopper, looking a lot more athletic than his face and general demeanor would lead you to expect, and jogs across the parking lot directly toward Hiro. This is the kind of guy Hiro remembers from when his dad was in the army. Not the gristly veterans of legends and movies, just sort of regular 35-year-old guys rattling around in bulky uniforms. He's a major. His name, sewn into his BDUs, is Clem.
Hiro protagonist?
The same. Juanita sent me to pick you up. She said you'd recognize the name. I recognize the name, but I don't really work for Juanita. She says you do now. Well, that's nice, Hero says. So I guess it's kind of urgent? I think that would be a fair assumption, Major Clem says. Can I spare a few minutes, because I've been working out and I need to run next door? Major Clem looks next door. The next logo down the strip is the rest stop. The situation is fairly static. You could spare 5 minutes, Major Clem says. Hero has an account with the rest stop. To live at the used store, you sort of have to have an account. So he gets to bypass the front office where the attendant waits by the cash register. He shoves his membership card into a slot, and a computer screen lights up with three choices. M, F, Nursery, which is unisex. Hero slaps the M button. Then the screen changes to a menu of four choices. Our special limited facilities, thrifty but sanitary. Standard facilities, just like home, maybe just a little better. Prime facilities, a gracious place for the discriminating patron. The Lavatory Grand Royal. He has to override a well-worn reflex to stop himself from automatically punching special limited facilities, which is what he and all the other U-Stored residents always use. Almost impossible to go in there and not come in contact with someone else's bodily fluids. Not a pretty sight. Not at all gracious. Instead, what the fuck, Juanita's gonna hire him, right? He slams the button for Lavatory Grand Royal. Never been here before. It's like something on the top floor of a luxury high-rise casino in Atlantic City, where they put semi-retarded adults from South Philly after they've blundered into the mega jackpot. It's got everything that a dim-witted, pathological gambler would identify with luxury. Gold-plated fixtures, lots of injection-molded pseudo-marble, velvet drapes, and a butler. None of the U-Stored residents ever use the Lavatory Grand Royal. The only reason it's here is that this place happens to be across the street from LAX. Singaporean CEOs who want to have a shower and take a nice leisurely crap with all the sound effects without having to hear and smell other travelers doing the same can come here and put it all on their corporate travel card. The butler is a 30-year-old Central American whose eyes look a little funny, like they've been closed for the last several hours. He is just throwing some improbably thick towels over his arm as Hero bursts in.
Gotta get in and out in 5 minutes, Hero says.
You want shave?
The butler says. He paws at his own cheeks suggestively, unable to peg Hero's ethnic group.
Love to. No time.
He peels off his jockey shorts, tosses his swords onto the crushed velvet sofa, and steps into the marbleized amphitheater of the shower stall. Hot water hits him from all directions at once. There's a knob on the wall so you can choose your favorite temperature. Afterward, he'd like to take a dump, read some of those glossy phone book-sized magazines next to the high-tech shitter, but he's got to get going. He dries himself off with a fresh towel the size of a circus tent, yanks on some loose drawstring slacks and a t-shirt, throws some Kong bucks at the butler, and runs out, girding himself with the swords. It's a short flight, mostly because the military pilot is happy to eschew comfort in favor of speed. The chopper takes off at a shallow angle, keeping low so it won't get sucked into any jumbo jets. And as soon as the pilot gets room to maneuver, he whips the tail around, drops the nose, and lets the rotor yank them onward and upward across the basin toward the sparsely lit mass of the Hollywood Hills. But they stop short of the hills and end up on the roof of a hospital. Part of the Mercy Chain, which technically makes this Vatican airspace. So far, this has Juanita written all over it.
Neurology ward, Major Clem says, delivering this string of nouns like an order. Fifth floor, east wing, room 564.
The man in the hospital bed is David.
Extremely thick, wide leather straps have been stretched across the head and foot of the bed. Leather cuffs lined with fluffy sheepskin are attached to the straps. These cuffs have been fastened around David's wrists and ankles. He's wearing a hospital gown that has mostly fallen off. The worst thing is that his eyes don't always point in the same direction. He's hooked up to an EKG that's charting his heartbeat, and even though Hiro's not a doctor, he can see it's not a regular pattern. It beats too fast, then it doesn't beat at all, then an alarm sounds, then it starts beating again. He has gone completely blank. His eyes are not seeing anything. At first, Hiro thinks that his body is limp and relaxed. Getting closer, he sees that David is taut and shivering, slick with perspiration. "We put in a temporary pacemaker," a woman says. Hiro turns. It's a nun, who also appears to be a surgeon. "How long has he been in convulsions?"
"His ex-wife called us in, said she was worried."
"Juanita?"
"Yes. When the paramedics arrived, he had fallen out of his chair at home and was convulsing on the floor. You can see a bruise here where we think his computer fell off the table and hit him in the ribs. So to protect him from further damage, we put him in 4 points. But for the last half hour, he's been like this. Like his whole body is in fibrillation. If he stays this way, we'll take the restraints off."
"Was he wearing goggles?"
"I don't know. I can check for you."
"But you think this happened while he was goggled into his computer?"
"I really don't know, sir. All I know is he's got such bad cardiac arrhythmia that we had to implant a temporary pacemaker right there on his office floor. We gave him some seizure medication, which didn't work. Put him on some downers to calm him, which worked slightly. Put his head into various pieces of imaging machinery to find out what the problem was. The jury is still out on that."
"Well, I'm going to go look at his house," Hiro says. The doctor shrugs. "Let me know when he comes out of it," Hiro says. The doctor doesn't say anything to this. For the first time, Hiro realizes that David's condition may not be temporary. As Hiro is stepping out into the hallway, David speaks.
"In him ni agi agi ni mumamadam inem amankiga agi agi."
Hiro turns around and looks. David has gone limp in the restraints, seems relaxed, half asleep. He is looking at Hiro through half-closed eyes.
"Inem damgal nunna agi agi inem umun abzuka agi agi agi."
David's voice is deep and placid, with no trace of stress. The syllables roll off his tongue like drool. As Hiro walks down the hallway, he can hear David talking all the way.
"Igen, igen, ugen, ugen, usatura lura zenemen."
Hiro gets back into the chopper. They cruise up the middle of Beechwood Canyon, headed straight for the Hollywood sign. David's house has been transfigured by light. It's at the end of its own little road at the summit of a hill. The road has been blocked off by a squat, frog-like jeep thing from General Jim's, saturated red and blue light sweeping and pulsing out of it. Another helicopter is above the house, supported on a swirling column of radiance. Soldiers creep up and down the property, carrying handheld searchlights.
"We took the precaution of securing the area," Major Clem says.
At the fringes of all this light, Hiro can see the dead organic colors of the hillside. The soldiers are trying to push it back with their searchlights, trying to burn it away. He is about to bury himself in it, become a single muddy pixel in some airline passenger's window, plunging into the biomass. David's laptop is on the floor, next to the table where he liked to work. It is surrounded by medical debris. In the middle of this, Hiro finds David's goggles, which either fell off when he hit the floor or were stripped off by the paramedics. Hiro picks up the goggles.
As he brings them up toward his eyes, he sees the image, a wall of black and white static. David's computer has snow crashed. He closes his eyes and drops the goggles. You can't get hurt by looking at a bitmap. Or can you? The house is sort of a modernist castle with a high turret on one end. David and Hiro and the rest of the hackers used to go up there with a case of beer and a hibachi and just spend a whole night eating jumbo shrimp and crab legs and oysters and washing them down with beer. Now it's deserted, of course. Just the hibachi, which is rusted and almost buried in gray ash, like an archaeological relic. Hiro has pinched one of David's beers from the fridge, and he sits up here for a while in what used to be his favorite place, drinking his beer slowly, like he used to, reading stories in the lights. The old central neighborhoods are packed in tight, below an eternal organic haze. In other cities, you breathe industrial contaminants, but in L.A., you breathe amino acids. The hazy sprawl is ringed and netted with glowing lines like hot wires in a toaster. At the outlet of the canyon, it comes close enough that the light sharpens and breaks up into stars, arches, glowing letters. Streams of red and white corpuscles throb down highways to the fuzzy logic of intelligent traffic lights. Farther away, spreading across the basin, a million sprightly logos smear into solid arcs, like geometric points merging into curves. To either side of the franchise ghettos, the loglo dwindles across a few shallow layers of development and into a surrounding dimness that is burst here and there by the blaze of a security spotlight in someone's backyard. The franchise and the virus work on the same principle. What thrives in one place will thrive in another. You just have to find a sufficiently virulent business plan, condense it into a three-ring binder, its DNA, Xerox it, and embed it in the fertile lining of a well-traveled highway, preferably one with a left turn lane. Then the growth will expand until it runs up against its property lines. In olden times, you'd wander down to Mom's Cafe for a bite to eat and a cup of joe, and you would feel right at home. It worked just fine if you never left your hometown. But if you went to the next town over, everyone would look up and stare at you when you came in the door, and the blue plate special would be something you didn't recognize. If you did enough traveling, you'd never feel at home anywhere. But when a businessman from New Jersey goes to Dubuque, he knows he can walk into a McDonald's and no one will stare at him. He can order without having to look at the menu, and the food will always taste the same. McDonald's is home, condensed into a three-ring binder and Xeroxed. No surprises is the motto of the franchise ghetto. Its good housekeeping seal, subliminally blazoned on every sign and logo that make up the curves and grids of light that outline the basin. The people of America, who live in the world's most surprising and terrible country, take comfort in that motto. Follow the loglo outward, to where the growth is enfolded into the valleys and the canyons, and you find the land of the refugees. They have fled from the true America, the America of atomic bombs, scalpings, hip-hop, chaos theory, cement overshoes, snake handlers, spree killers, spacewalks, buffalo jumps, drive-bys, cruise missiles, Sherman's March, gridlock, motorcycle gangs, and bungee jumping. They have parallel parked their bimbo boxes in identical computer-designed burbclave street patterns and secreted themselves in symmetrical sheetrock shitholes with vinyl floors and ill-fitting woodwork and no sidewalks, vast house farms out in the loglo wilderness, a culture medium for a medium culture. The only ones left in the city are street people feeding off debris. Immigrants thrown out like shrapnel from the destruction of the Asian powers, young bohos, and the techno-media priesthood of Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. Young, smart people like David and Hiro who take the risk of living in the city because they like stimulation and they know they can handle it.